Welcome to Enabled, the weekly program about people just like you who are dealing with issues of vision loss. The program is designed to encourage you through news you can use, inspirational stories, and interviews. I'm Nancy Zimmer, your host for Enabled. Thank you for joining me. Today, I'll continue with last week's topic by bringing you more information about Braille. First, there'll be a quick story about Louis Braille and how he developed this useful language. And then, you'll get the answer to a question that puzzles a lot of people. Stay tuned. You'll also hear information about Helen Keller and maybe get some insight into how people who are blind dream. All this information came from a website I found that's called todayifoundout.com. This website has a subtitle of Feed Your Brain. It accumulates interesting information on just random topics, and I've chosen a few about blindness to share with you today. So that first issue, Who Invented Braille? This article was written by Emily Upton. Braille was invented by a 19th century man named Louis Braille, who was completely blind. Braille's story starts when he was 3 years old. He was playing in his father's shop in Couvray, France, and somehow managed to injure his eye. Though he was offered the best medical attention available at the time, it wasn't enough. An infection soon developed and spread to his other eye, rendering blind in both eyes. While a tragedy for him, had this accident not happened, we would not have Braille today. There was a system of reading in place for the blind at the time, which consisted of tracing a finger along raised letters. However, this system meant that reading was painfully slow, and it was difficult to discern by touch the relatively complex letters of the alphabet. As a result, many people struggled to master what they call the embossed letter system. In 1821, Louis Braille's teacher, Dr. Alexandre Pignard, invited a man named Charles Barbier to speak to a classroom of young blind students at the National Institute for Blind Youth in Paris. Barbier had developed what he called a night writing system for the military using raised dots. Napoleon had requested a system of communication that soldiers could use even in the darkness without making any sound in the process. Barbier's system was too complex for the military and was rejected. However, it was thought that it might be useful for people who are blind, which led Dr. Pignard to invite Barbier to come and demonstrate it. As it stood, the Barbier invention wasn't quite up to functioning as a system of touch-based reading and writing, being overly complex. It used a 6x6 dot matrix to represent letters and certain phonemes. Furthermore, this large dot matrix made it so unless you had very large fingertips, you could not feel all the dots in a single matrix without moving your finger. Still, Braille was inspired. And as a young teenager, he began experimenting. He took a piece of paper, a slate, and a stylus. He punched holes, and he attempted to find something that worked. And this was way back in 1821 when these things started. Now we move forward to 1825. Braille was just barely 16, but he thought he had hit upon something that was functional and superior to the existing embossed letter system. His original code consists of 6 dots arranged in 2 parallel rows, each set of rows representing a letter. This configuration was simpler than Barbier's system, but still versatile enough to allow for up to 64 variations, enough for all letters of the alphabet and punctuation. It was also easily adapted to languages other than French. Most importantly, rather than needing to trace out a whole letter, it was much easier to feel the configuration of dots, making reading for the blind significantly faster and easier. Dr. Pignard was pleased with Braille's work and encouraged his students to use Braille's new system. Unfortunately, when Dr. Pignard introduced what he called the History of France, written in Braille, for his students, he was dismissed from his position as headmaster due to his insistence on pushing Braille's system rather than the standard embossed letter system of the day. Nonetheless, Braille himself became a teacher at the Institute and taught his code to the students who passed through, spreading his knowledge. In 1834, when Louis Braille was in his mid-20s, he was invited to demonstrate the uses of Braille at the Exposition of Industry. This was being held in Paris that year, and this further spurred its popularity. By this time, Braille had also published a book about how to use his code. It was mostly written in embossed letters, with Braille thrown in to demonstrate its use. Despite this, the National Institute for the Blind Youth that Braille worked at still refused to officially adopt his system. It wouldn't be until 1854, 2 years after Braille died, and 8 years after a school in Amsterdam started using it as their primary reading and writing system. 1854, Braille's former school finally adopted Braille due to students overwhelmingly demanding the change. By the late 19th century, Braille had been adopted throughout most of the world, except the United States. The United States held out until 1916. And there you have Who Invented Braille from the website todayifoundout.com. So next, we have that question that I tempted you with. The question that a lot of people are wondering. The question is, why is there Braille on a drive-through ATM machine? This article was written by David Hiskey, again, from that website, Today I Found Out. David Hiskey replies, "Today I found out why there is Braille on drive-through ATM machines. Mainly, it's because it is required by law. This is thanks to the ADA accessibility guidelines for buildings and facilities. There are certain exceptions in terms of these requirements when it comes to drive-up ATMs versus walk-up ATMs, such as the differing requirements on the reach ranges. However, being able to get rid of the Braille is not one of these exceptions, despite initial protests from the American Bankers Association, who argued that any visually impaired person could simply get the driver to help. The committee in charge of coming up with these standards rejected this argument because it would no longer allow a visually impaired person to use the ATM independently. And blind people actually do use the drive-up ATMs all the time, too, contrary to what many people think. It's not uncommon at all for them to run errands in a taxi cab, for instance. When they do, a drive-up ATM is certainly more convenient for a blind person, given that someone can drive them right up to the ATM, and they probably wouldn't want to trust their cab driver with their card and their PIN number. Up until somewhat recently, though, a more interesting question might have been, why do even walk-up ATMs have Braille, when many ATMs don't have any facility or any ability for letting the blind person know what's happening on the screen? Well, this situation has since been improved, but for a long time, there were no set ways to make the interaction with the ATM beyond the Braille accessible to the visually impaired. Initially, no one was really sure what the best way to handle this aspect of accessibility would be, so the accessibility guidelines didn't address it. Indeed, in the early days, quite a lot of banks simply provided Braille instruction manually for a given ATM, and the visually impaired user would need to follow the steps exactly in order to do a certain task and hope that nothing went wrong or that the ATM didn't suddenly or hadn't suddenly gotten a software update that changed that interaction. These instructions can still be found on many ATMs, but today there is also generally some sort of audible system to let the visually impaired user know what's happening on the screen. This is usually done through a headphone jack for privacy. You'll also often hear people say that the reason behind this has to do with being cheaper to make one ATM machine rather than two different models. Or in a similar vein, cheaper to have one set of buttons with Braille than one with and one without. Well, this may or may not be true, but given the American Bankers Association fight to try to remove requirements to make the drive-up ATMs accessible to the visually impaired, it would seem that this cheaper factor, if it exists, wasn't a contributing factor. So next, this author has included three extra bonus facts. The first one is, these days, books for the blind in English are typically written in grade 2 Braille. This is a system that combines letters and substitutes letters for words. For instance, the letter Y is used to represent the word you, and the letter B represents the word but. In some respects, grade 2 Braille is a lot like chat speak. It takes shortcuts to make for an easier reading and writing experience. In addition to taking a shorter time to read, it also takes up less space, saving paper used on those Braille books. The second bonus fact, today, English-speaking blind children are mostly taught grade 2 Braille, though grade 1 Braille, where every letter is written out, is still sometimes taught in early elementary school. There is also a grade 3 Braille for any non-standard shorthands. And the third bonus fact for you, Braille also developed a system, this is Louis Braille, known as DecaPoint. DecaPoint configurations more closely resemble letters, making it easier for sighted people to read it. He even helped develop a machine that would make DecaPoint easier to write so that the dots didn't have to be handwritten with a stylus. It was called a raphograph, and it was developed with the help of Pierre-François Victor Foucault in the late 1830s and early 1840s. Next, I have an article also from the website, Today I Found Out. This one is perhaps a revelation to you. I'm not sure I paid attention to the facts when I was younger. The headline reads, Helen Keller was not born blind or deaf. This article was also written by David Hiskey. The myth is that Helen Keller was born blind and deaf. In fact, Helen Keller was born able to see and hear just fine, and she continued to be able to do so until she was about 1.5 years old. At that time, she became sick with some type of illness. What that particular illness was isn't entirely known. However, it is thought that it might have been scarlet fever or meningitis. The symptoms were described as being an acute congestion of the stomach and brain. Whatever the cause, after she recovered her health, unfortunately, she then could not see or hear. Another common myth is that she had no way of communicating with her family until her teacher arrived approximately around her 7th birthday. Well, in fact, she had a very limited communication method involving about 60 home signs that she used, mostly in communicating with Martha Washington. Martha was the child of the Keller family cook and was Helen Keller's playmate. In 1886, when Helen Keller was 6 years old, her mother read Charles Dickens' book American Notes, which were accounts of his travels through North America in 1842. The particular bit of those writings that intrigued her was a part about a deaf-blind woman who was successfully educated, something she had previously thought would not be possible for Helen. She then sought to find a teacher for her daughter. Her search eventually led her to the famed inventor Alexander Graham Bell, who at the time was a teacher of deaf children. Incidentally, his wife and mother were both deaf. Well, Alexander Graham Bell then recommended Helen's parents to the Perkins Institute for the Blind in South Boston. Once there, a 20-year-old visually impaired woman by the name of Annie Sullivan was asked to become Helen Keller's instructor, and eventually governess and constant companion. Their relationship lasted in this way for nearly 50 years. Now, this author, on his way to finding out something new for today, included lots of bonus facts. I found a lot of them very, very interesting. I'll share them with you. First, despite being deaf and blind, Helen Keller managed to learn to speak and could even read lips by touching people's lips as they spoke. She could also similarly read sign language with her hands, as well as use it to communicate with other deaf people. Her ability to speak particularly aided her, as she would frequently give various lectures and speeches as an adult. She also became an accomplished writer. Next, Helen Keller's father, at one time, was a captain in the Confederate Army. Furthermore, her grandmother on her father's side was a second cousin of Robert E. Lee. On top of that, her grandfather on her mother's side, Charles Adams, was a brigadier general in the Confederate Army. Next, Keller also had an ancestor from Zurich, Switzerland, that was the first teacher of deaf people in Zurich. This was an ancestor of hers. Next, at the age of 30, Keller's eyes were removed and replaced with glass eyeballs. The motivation behind this was primarily cosmetic, and this was at the encouragement of her family, because while one of her eyes looked normal, the other eye bulged out significantly, marring an otherwise reasonably attractive face. For this reason, most pictures of Keller before the operation were taken from the good side that hided her bulging eye. Next, the first thing that Annie Sullivan taught Keller was the word doll. When she arrived in 1887 at the Keller's home, she brought the gift of a doll for Helen. She then placed it in her one hand while tracing the letters of the word doll in Keller's other hand repeatedly. The learning process was exceptionally slow at first because Keller didn't really understand things like objects having names. After around a month, though, when she realized the tracings on her hands were indicating the name of what was in her other hand, she immediately became like a sponge for information. She didn't like to take any breaks and wanted to know the names of everything around her. When I was in Washington recently, I was in the ante room for some of the congressional areas and found that famous statue of Helen Keller along with Annie Sullivan. They're standing at a water pump like the kind you'd find outside in your yard. The water's coming out of the pump, and the statue depicts Helen Keller, holding her hand under the water. And as I recall, that was one of the seminal moments in her training when she felt the water and then could put a word along with the word water, along with the feeling of water. So that statue is in Washington. Okay, another bonus fact for you. Keller was good friends with Mark Twain, the two having originally met when she was 16. Twain played a key role in her life, introducing her to someone named Henry Huddleston Rogers. He was an extremely successful self-made businessman, making his millions when the oil industry first began to boom. At the encouragement of Twain, Huddleston Rogers, which is what we have to call him, I guess, Henry Huddleston Rogers, the oil man, saw to it that Keller had plenty of money for her education, which allowed her to earn a Bachelor of Arts degree from Radcliffe College. She was the first deaf-blind person to earn a degree. He also gave her a monthly stipend throughout most of her life. Interestingly, Henry Huddleston Rogers was a descendant of pilgrims who arrived on the Mayflower. Not only that, but his childhood sweetheart, who eventually became his wife, was also a descendant from the pilgrims who arrived on the Mayflower. This was Henry Huddleston, I think it's pronounced, Rogers, Huddleston, Henry Huddleston Rogers. And besides being a close friend of Mark Twain's, Rogers was also extremely close friends with the famous African-American leader and teacher Booker T. Washington. The friendship of these two was originally kindled after Rogers saw a speech given by Washington in 1894 in Madison Square Garden. After that point, Washington frequently guested with Rogers in Rogers' 85-room mansion and on Rogers' yacht. Through this friendship, Rogers was inspired to fund around 65 schools for African Americans, as well as providing much of the funding for the Tuskegee and Hampton Institutes. And this little side biography that we got into is about Henry Huddleston Rogers and his connection with Booker T. Washington. So Mark Twain, back to him, wasn't Keller's only famed correspondent. She also met every U.S. president between Grover Cleveland and Lyndon B. Johnson. She also became friends with Alexander Graham Bell herself and Charlie Chaplin. Further, she frequently corresponded with famed Austrian philosopher Wilhelm Jerusalem, who encouraged her writing talent. Keller wrote 12 books in her lifetime, along with a series of articles on various topics. Interestingly, the first story she ever wrote at the age of 11 was called The Frost King. This was extremely similar to the story The Frost Fairies by Margaret Canby, despite the fact that she had only been exposed to this story as a baby, which she did not consciously remember. Keller eventually suffered a series of strokes beginning in 1961, which stopped most all of her public appearances. She died on June 1, 1968, in her sleep. She was cremated, with her ashes placed beside her two great friends and constant companions through life, her teacher Annie Sullivan and her later friend and caretaker Polly Thompson. But 4 years before her death, President Lyndon B. Johnson awarded Keller the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and 1 year later, she was elected to the National Women's Hall of Fame. Another bonus fact for you, other famous deaf-blind people include Sanzan Tani, who by the time he reached adulthood was fully deaf and blind, though he overcame this and continued to function as a teacher. There's also Laura Bridgman. You've heard about her before on this program. She was the first American child to be fully educated around 50 years before Helen Keller. There's also Robert Smithdas, who became the first deaf-blind person to receive a master's degree, specializing in vocational guidance and rehabilitation for people who are handicapped. For a time, he worked with Helen Keller. There's also Heinrich Landesmann, who was an Austrian poet and philosopher who developed a form of tactile signing that is now named after him. That was Heinrich Landesmann. Another interesting fact, Robert Smithdas is actually still alive today, only retiring in 2008 at the age of 83 years old. Interestingly, his wife Michelle is also deaf-blind. Well, this leads one to wonder, how do the two do things like locate one another in their home? Presumably something to do with using vibrations in the floor or something like that. In any case, it would be fascinating to learn about such things. The next little fact for you, like Helen Keller, Laura Bridgman was also born fully able to use her vision and hearing. However, while only 2 years old, her family, the whole family, contracted scarlet fever, which resulted in the death of her two sisters and brother. It further left her not only blind and deaf, but also without the ability to taste or smell. She was soon very rudimentarily taught by a friend of the family who enjoyed taking her out for walks. He himself was not able to teach her any language, though. Interestingly, despite the lack of language in her early years, she became quite skilled at knitting and sewing. And then we come to one of my favorites, along with the Hadley School for the Blind. This one's called Perkins School for the Blind. Perkins is the oldest school for the blind in the United States, being founded in 1829. It was named after one of the founders who was a very wealthy, visually impaired shipping merchant. And now we wonder, this is really nothing to do with Braille, but the question sort of made me wonder, how do people who are blind dream? Today I found out, said David Hiskey, today I found out how the completely blind dream. It turns out that if they went completely blind before approximately the ages of 5 to 7 years old, they will typically dream without any visual experience. In the very few cases where some report having visual experiences in their dreams, these experiences are more in the abstract sense, where they feel like they were seeing something, even though they couldn't actually recollect or describe it when they woke up. They couldn't actually describe what things looked like or what they actually saw when they woke up. This is similar to how occasionally in dreams you just know something, even though there is nothing specifically that you are experiencing in the dream which should indicate what you know. For instance, in a dream, when you wake up, you remember feeling like you were in danger in the dream, even though nothing you can recall in the dream indicated any danger. There was just some abstract sense of it. So outside of the interesting, quote-unquote, around the age of 5 to 7 cutoff time for visual dream experiences, the dreams of those who are completely blind before this age tend to be principally auditory in nature. However, what is also fascinating is that compared to those who can see and hear, people who are blind report drastically increased taste, smell, and touch sensations in their dreams, not just auditory sensations taking over for the lack of visual sensations. Now, if people go completely blind after around that age of 5 to 7, the vast majority of completely blind people will, at first, dream very similar dreams to those who are not blind, albeit, once again, with a more non-visual sensory experience than is reported by those who can see and hear. But nevertheless, their visual experiences in their dreams tend to be quite similar to those who can see. If they had diminished vision early on in life, though, perhaps only seeing colors, then their visual experiences in their dreams tend to be similarly diminished based on those visual experiences. As time passes, they typically will report more and more prevalence of experiences from their other senses, and less of the visual experiences in their dreams. Often the visual experiences will become more vague or blurry as time passes, but they do seem to remain, to some extent, throughout the blind person's entire life. Now back to Helen Keller with this final note here. Helen Keller, in her autobiography, comments about her dreams by saying, "My dreams have strangely changed during the past 12 years. Before and after my teacher first came to me, they were devoid of sound, of thought, or emotion of any kind except fear, and only came in the form of sensations. I would often dream that I ran into a still, dark room, and that while I stood there, I felt something fall heavily, without any noise, causing the floor to shake up and down violently, and each time I woke up with a jump. As I learned more and more about objects around me, this strange dream ceased to haunt me, but I was in a high state of excitement and received impressions very easily. It is not strange, then, that I dreamed at the time of a wolf, which seemed to rush toward me and put his cruel teeth deep into my body. I could not speak. The fact was, I could only spell with my fingers. I could not speak, and I tried to scream, but no sound escaped from my lips. It is very likely that I had heard the story of Red Riding Hood and was deeply impressed by it. This dream, however, passed away in time, and I began to dream of objects outside of myself." Well, did you know the Alabama State Quarter is the only circulating U.S. coin to feature Braille? You know why? That's because Helen Keller was born in Alabama. A quote for you to think about today is from Helen Adams Keller, an American author, political activist, and lecturer. She has a lot of good quotes to her credit, but the one I picked for you today is this one. "I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do." Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week. You've been listening to Enabled, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. Our technical director is Maureen Rich, and I'm Nancy Zimmer. I hope you'll join me again next week for more updates and information and encouraging stories. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can listen to it at our website, wxxi.org.